PFT Media.
All episodes of The Experience with Chris Fio were recorded prior to the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is The Experience with Chris Fio. In each episode, Fio brings his unique and unashamed interview style to Central Florida. He conducts honest and open interviews with people that have the vocabulary and expertise that he lacks.
I had the good fortune to meet and have a wonderful conversation with the artist Josh Garrick. Josh warmly welcomed me at his amazing home, which is more like a museum. After showing me all of his treasures, we sat down to talk about art, having both national and international success, and how it feels to survive cancer and find true love.
Gun in a holster, that vision is slipping like a worn transmission. The days of transporting and not transmitting, cause the transcontinental flow got me transient. I'm transcribed the transcript, I fell in a trance.
Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of The Experience with Chris Fio. Today I have with me artist and art collector and curator Josh Garrick. Hello Josh, how have you been?
Hey Chris, glad to have you.
Thank you, glad that you have me over here in your home, the home of Josh Garrick. And since this is audio, a lot of you can't see until the pictures come out, is this man has probably one of the biggest art collections I've seen personally, and it's a lot of Greek-influenced art, and that brings me to my first question. Your art that you surround yourself by is Greece. How did you get so ensconced in the Greek culture?
That's one of the craziest questions, because it's always one of the first questions that happens.
Yeah.
And I don't have a good answer for it.
Right.
The only thing that I can do is I can go back to seventh grade, okay, high school. And I come from an abusive childhood.
I understand.
Part of what my childhood had to do with was seeking approval, seeking acceptance and that kind of thing. And so in seventh grade, anyway, to the better side of it, in seventh grade, I created this little Parthenon out of plaster of Paris. You're too young, but we used to have these things that were molds. So I had a thing that made a mold of a pillar. So, I mean, a whole bunch of those.
Oh, wow.
And then I created this little plaster of Paris Parthenon. I mean, I have no idea at this point. I mean, I don't have any pictures from it from, you know, way back then, but... So I have no idea if I even came close to the right number of pillars or anything. You know, all I know is that I had this white plaster of Paris thing, and of course I got an A on it. And then, because I'm a farm boy from Pennsylvania, originally,
I would not expect that.
No, I'm glad to hear that. But I mean that was my background. And so the biggest thing that would happen every year for us was the state fair.
Okay. And what did the state fair consist of?
Well, all that stuff you've heard about, like, you know, cattle breeding and
basically
rides and, you know, like, I mean, it was the biggest thing that would happen in...
Sort of like what you'd see in some movies, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, as a matter of fact, I think there is a movie named State Fair, and, I think it's Elvis Presley. Anyway.
Really? I'll ask my grandma. She probably knows
that. Yeah, right. Talk to your...
No, she's a big Elvis fan. She has Elvis everywhere.
That? He jumped right over the generation there. He went right for the grandmother. Okay. So
I'm so sorry.
Smart kid. So anyway, I enter my little A project Parthenon into the state fair for, like, high school entry stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And I got the blue ribbon. I got to feel good about myself with it. And so I don't know if that just stuck with me, because I mean, there's really no Greek in my background that I know of.
Yeah.
But I know ever since I was a child, I have had this fascination with ancient Greece. And by that, I'm talking about classical Greece.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, once you get to know parts of it, I mean, you know, there was the archaic period, there was the, you know, the neo whatever and all that. I mean, the
different
period
stages.
Of time when there was the Trojan War, for example.
Oh, wow.
Example.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that goes back to 1200 BC.
Now, you were mentioning earlier, like, the evolution of art when you were showing me around, like, how one piece became into another, like the Greek symbol that you were, or the Roman
right.
symbol that you were
right.
showing me.
Yeah.
Greek or Roman? I don't.
It's Greek.
Greek, the Greek symbol. And it was.
And it's called, right? It's called the Greek key. That's what it's called.
Mm. And that brings me, like, you know, since you were big into Greece, each one of these times, they had their own distinct art style, you would say?
Well, just like any other civilization that lasted for a long time, there were periods of time when they would go into a dark period. I mean, right after the Trojan War, for example, it went into what was called the Dark Age of Greece, and that's when a whole mass of people came down from the north, from like Macedonia, into what is today proper Greece. And started their own city-states, and then that evolved over hundreds of years into what we eventually think of as classical Greece, which is actually classical Athens, because the other cities didn't have what Athens did. I mean, the Parthenon, for example, which is always the number one example.
Yeah. Which you have taken pictures of too.
I've had, well, I call the piece, that one piece that I showed you, I call it the greatest day of my life. I was the only American ever allowed to climb the scaffolding around the Parthenon.
Really?
And go to the roof of the Parthenon and do a photo shoot.
How long did that take to get like for you to be allowed to do something like that? What did
Years.
You have to do?
Years.
Really?
Well, yeah, I've over the years I've led 15 student groups to Greece. I mean, 15 college student groups to Greece. And so what happened is, I mean, over the years the Greek government noticed that there was this crazy American who was introduced. I mean, over the years, of course, I introduced hundreds of young people to Greece. And in many cases, it was the first time that some of them had ever gone overseas. I mean, out of the United States.
That's incredible.
So imagine, you know, being young, college age, and having your first experience be ancient Greece. And I loved it. I first of all, I love teaching. I really do. And
you were teaching at where exactly?
The School of Visual Arts in New York City.
Oh, wow. How long did you do that for?
I was there from 84 to 96, something
wow.
like that. Yeah.
That's incredible.
But the trip to Greece went on. I mean, even after I moved from New York City to Orlando, can you imagine?
Yeah, that's a big shock. And actually a growing trend. A lot of New Yorkers have been coming down to Florida and Orlando lately.
Well, what I found, because I'm always very calculated when I do something. And when I decided that what I wanted to do was leave New York City, and the biggest reason I wanted to leave New York City was because I hate the cold. I mean, and during the winter, New York City is bleeping cold.
Yeah.
And so I would find myself living through the winter.
Like, I mean, surviving.
Yeah, right.
Oh, gosh. I
can
imagine.
But then it was the snowstorm of 96. The snowstorm of 96. You probably weren't even born there.
I was born in 89, but I don't remember that. I was still a young kid playing outside, so
okay.
I wouldn't know.
All right. Anyway. I will forgive you for that. Okay.
Thank you.
So anyway, it was the snowstorm of 96 in New York City. It shut down the city. It literally shut down the city for a week. I mean,
wow.
No groceries, no moving around. I mean, they had to like bring in trucks to take the snow out of the city. You couldn't move anywhere. I mean, and
wow.
And when people see those idealized photos of New York City with snow all over the place,
yeah.
Well, dude, you better get that picture real fast because because after it snows, it only takes like a couple of hours for everybody's dog to come out and mess up the snow. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay, okay.
So it's snow in New York City is not fun. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. There is no fun to be had in New York City in snow.
Okay, loud and heard loud and clear.
Right. And so I decided to move to Florida. Hawaii was too far away. California don't like it. It's cold and it's damp. That's why the lady is a tramp. And so I decided I was coming down to Florida. So what I did first was I went to Miami because that's what New Yorkers do.
Yeah.
We go to Miami.
Right. Why is that?
I don't know. There's no good reason that I can think of. And so anyway, I didn't like Miami. I mean, everybody else seemed to love it, but not for me. So I visited a couple of other places, always thinking that I wanted to be on the shoreline.
Yeah.
Like either the Gulf or the Atlantic. But then, of course, I started doing my studies and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. There's this thing called a hurricane. Okay, now I don't like being cold in New York. And I think I would like even less to be homeless because of a hurricane. And so that really helped guide my decision to come to Orlando. And then so again, I came to Orlando to check it out, and it was such a great time. I really had a wonderful, wonderful time. Disney World, the whole thing. We didn't have half of the art that we have today.
Yeah, I could imagine it was different, but you know, a couple maybe yeah, decades ago.
We're talking 22 years ago, and Orlando did not look anything like it looks today. I mean, I am so, so proud of our city. As a matter of fact, I'm wearing an Orlando t-shirt. This is, we are Orlando.
And that is true. And you've been living here for 20 years now. 22.
Yeah.
And it caught on to you so much that you couldn't leave.
Moving into this home was probably the best decision I ever made in my life. I am so happy here. And of course I have my pool.
Yes, you do.
And I can even swim in the winter.
Yes, because it's not going to be as cold as New York winter at all.
Right. I mean, I was in the pool this morning.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, see, Florida winter allows you to go into the pool.
Yeah. I mean, it was really cold. I didn't stay in for long. But I mean, you know, when you get into a cold pool, eventually you
warm up eventually.
Yeah, you get into it.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's that deal.
Yeah. And another one question I have is like about the Parthenon, like how did that go about? Like you were telling me earlier, like how difficult it was to even attempt that. Like, can you tell me that again?
Well, I have two friends to whom I owe more than I can ever say. The first one is named Marius Voutsinas, who he and I have been friends since we were college kids. And my wonderful curator, Iris Kritikou, who had the guts to go to the Archaeological Museum of Greece and say to the director there, I would like you to look at the work of an American photographer. Now, I mean, I have no idea why he didn't laugh her out of his office. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, this of course had never happened. And so this is 2012. By 2013, I became the only living artist in the world to have a major exhibition inside the Archaeological Museum of Greece. And it's all thanks to Marius and Iris. So if you guys are listening, bless you, love you, thank you, all that.
I'm very sure they'll be listening. And like, that really took a lot of gusto to approach someone like that, especially being an American, because we're not really well-liked around the world. And just for someone to say, look, can this American here take a photograph of your Parthenon?
Right.
That takes a lot of gusto.
Yeah.
Incredible.
But again, see, I never would have gotten that had it not been for the Parthenon. I never would have gotten it without Marius. The Archaeological Museum never would have gotten it without Iris. And then we have to add a third there to Dr. George Kakavas, who is the director of the Archaeological Museum, or was the director. It's changed in the intervening 6 years.
Right.
At the time, he was the director. And he took a flyer on this American. And, well, of course, it changed my life.
Take me through that day, like, that you were going to take pictures of the Parthenon. What was your, how did you feel getting up that day?
The day of the Parthenon
thing? Yep.
Well, first of all, I didn't sleep much the night before. I think I checked all of my cameras, because, see, for something like that, that was going to be so completely unique, I went up, I had to climb the scaffolding. I mean, there's scaffolding all around the Parthenon, and I had to climb the scaffolding, and I was allowed to. This is the incredible
That's
thing.
Incredible.
So while I'm climbing, I realize, of course, it's the Parthenon. They won't allow me to put a tripod down. I mean,
right.
I could crack something, you know. And so I was my own tripod, and I had like four cameras hanging around my neck, and I had all, had checked them each like three times during the night because I wasn't sleeping anyway.
Wow.
And so I'm climbing up on this thing. And the first thing that I did not bargain for, now I knew it was going to be dangerous.
Yeah.
Because they don't have guardrails at the top of the Parthenon.
I mean,
it's them, it's the stonemasons, and that's it.
You and death, right?
And
there.
The stonemasons didn't speak a lot of English. So so here I am, you know, climbing up there, looking every part the photographer, I might add, you know, because of course I had one of those vests that had the stuff, you know, with the stuff all over it. Anyway. And so I go up there, and the thing that I did not account for was the wind.
How that must have been blowing up there.
Unbelievable. First of all, the Parthenon, of course, is on the highest spot of Athens. Mm. There's the base of the Parthenon. The pillars are 40 feet tall themselves.
Holy Jesus.
Then there is the whole area that's above the pillars before you get to the roof.
And that's
so,
like, what, another 15 feet?
Yeah, exactly. It's almost exactly 15 feet.
How did you know that? You're up there.
Okay. Wow. So anyway, it was crazy. And so I start to photograph, and I am saying to myself, this is the most important photo shoot of your life. Two, don't freak this up.
You're allowed to drop one F-bomb if you want.
I thought I handled that well.
Yes, you did. You did.
And third, don't die.
That's a big one.
And so I'm serious. I mean, there I was. I planted my feet wide, so I became my own tripod, and started taking shots. Now, the most amazing part of this was that it happened to be, and I mean, this is purely coincidental and to my great, great luck. It happened to be a day in which they were taking a piece of marble, the part of the original roof that weighed 2.5 tons.
Wow.
And they were putting it on this winch, and they were bringing it up. Can you imagine? They were bringing it up from the floor of the Parthenon to put it in place on the roof where it was supposed to go.
Wow. Okay.
So here I am. I'm
amazing.
On the roof, right?
And I'm taking pictures down on the workers. I mean, I'm literally like looking down on the workers as they're strapping this thing. Can you imagine what kind of strapping it takes to put a 2.5-ton piece of marble on top of the Parthenon?
Oh, my. That's quite a feat.
And so it's, Chris, it was so fantastic because what I got was click, 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 click. The piece of marble is rising, click, click, click. It's rising, click, click, click. It's moving to the left, click, click, click. It's moving over to the roof, click, 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 down into place. And now, here I am, working with the stonemasons. I mean, I'm right there in the middle of the stonemasons, and they were so cool because they were like, you know, like, who the hell is this guy, right? But they knew that they were having their picture taken, so that was kind of cool. And so I have actual photographs right there, for example. Look at the piece of marble coming down.
Oh, wow, look at that.
Do you see?
Yeah, that's an incredible photo.
So I have this whole series of photos from where it starts out sitting on the floor of the Parthenon, rises very slowly, click, 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 moves over, click, click, click,
click, click, click.
And so I have this whole series. I mean, besides the other pictures, which of course I have, the most fun for me is when I look at one of them and somebody says, or when I say, well, where do you think I was when I took this? And somebody will say, well, you had to be in a helicopter.
And well, I'm like, lo and behold, no, I'm not.
No, I was actually standing on the, I mean, it's, I have to pinch myself sometimes when I think, I mean, imagine these two things alone, Chris, that the Greek government has given to me. And then there's so much more, but the ability to be the only American to take those kinds of photographs. And by the way, they showed up in magazines, you know, for like the next 2 years.
Oh, wow.
I won an award from Photo District News for them. I mean, it was a big part of my life. And so what that did was it opened doors for me to go into other sacred places.
Wow.
To do even more shots because, well, you have to remember, I mean, I had been lecturing to these students at that time by like 10 years. And so, I mean, my master's degree is from Columbia University.
Yeah.
And it features, you know, ancient Greece. And so, I mean, I am even today in awe of all of this. And it's so incredible. I mean, when you read their history, I mean, even if, say, for example, all you ever do is read the graphic novel, The 300.
Right.
When I teach the actual Battle of Thermopylae, the 300.
Yeah.
I have never yet taught it without having tears come to my eyes. The unbelievable bravery of these men who knew it was a suicide mission. I mean, they went into it proudly, knowing that they would not come out of it alive. I mean, so 300 Spartans against thousands of creepy Persians. Oh God, I'll be crucified for that. But anyway,
it's all right. But that was the truth back, you know.
But really, I mean, thousands, where they had to literally climb over the bodies to continue the battle. Well, anyway,
that's incredible. Yeah,
but I mean, so that I only mentioned that as an example.
Yeah.
Of, I mean, and every ancient site in Greece has an incredible story, something like that to be told. It's not always a battle. I mean, sometimes it's the beginning of the Olympics, for example.
Yeah.
The Olympics started, what we know as the Olympics started in 776 BC in Olympia, Greece.
So that's the etymology of the name.
Yeah. See, that's me going into teaching mode. So when I do that, in Olympia. But that was the little note to my students.
Yeah.
Remember this. Remember this is going to be on the test.
You know? So I'm highlighting it with my voice.
No, that I'm serious. That's how I teach. I mean, I really do that.
And you've developed your teaching method yourself.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
All right. I mean, sure, right?
But yes. And also thanks to the teachers that I had over there as well.
Right.
I mean, can I say this? I learned more from the teachers that I had over there than I did from the time that I was at Columbia University.
You could perfectly say that.
And now I'll probably be disowned by Columbia University.
Columbia's like, no. They're probably over there just burning themselves down. Josh Derrick hates us. He thinks we're ignorant.
But no, it's really very simple. I mean, of course, you're going to learn more from the people who live there and have experienced it like every day of their lives.
Yeah.
I mean, lecturers generally will take one place. I mean, like, say, for example, somebody will do, I mean, they will lecture at Olympia, but they'll do it like every day. I was traveling around with the students. I would go to these different sites, like the most holy place in the world for over 1,000 years was Delphi, the home of the oracle. And so imagine, see, this is another thing that I do with my American students. Okay, how old is the United States?
241 years old.
Something like that. Okay. Delphi, Greece, was the most sacred place in the earth for over 1,000 years.
Oh my.
And when you go, you feel it. Not just because, frankly, there's not much left of the temple, but the feeling of the place, the smell of the place, Chris, because it smells like the fir trees. That I mean, there are fir trees all over the place, and there's this huge mountain that just like goes right up, you know, straight into the air. And of course, earthquakes have, you know, caused it to do incredible damage to things like the temples and stuff over thousands of years. Anyway, when you talk about, or when somebody asks me, what do I think is the most sacred place on earth? I agree with the people who believed it for over 1,000 years. Delphi is magnificent.
And have you taken any photos there?
Oh, of course.
No. Yeah,
I've taken a lot of photos there. No, I mean, if I love a place, of course I'm going to photograph it.
A little bit of a dumb question.
No. It's all right. Because it's funny, because of the fact that it does not lend itself as well to taking photographs, because the temple to Apollo, which was the big temple, I mean, you see the floor of the temple, so you know how big it was.
Right.
But there are only bits of columns that are left. So that part of it does not lend itself very well to taking photographs. However, the whole space itself was on the side of the mountain. Now remember, this is all on the side of a mountain. And one of the years when I had the students, we were staying in this one hotel where in Delphi, they literally build the hotels right into the side of the mountain. I mean,
so that
your room is like stone. Rough stone, and you know, and so you're in there, and you're sort of on the side of the mountain. And there was this one very memorable group that I had, and it, crazily enough, it was one of the largest groups that I had.
How many people were there?
I think they were like 20, 23, maybe, you know, in that year. Okay, so we get to Delphi, and all of Greece is an earthquake zone. So
I did not know that either.
Well, it is. And and so here we are, and we're staying in this hotel that's built into the side of the mountain. The scenery from this mountain view is beyond comprehension. It goes down the mountain over what is called the Sea of Olive Trees.
Wow.
Because the entire acres and acres, acres of olive trees, and then the water. So you reach the water. And so to see this
is
incredible. And the reason they call it the Sea of Olive Trees, the Sea of Olives, is because the olive leaf is dark green on the top and light green on the bottom. So imagine wind blowing through this sea of olive trees, and you're watching it almost like waves of the ocean, because it goes from dark green to light green, dark green to light green, dark green. It's
that's serene.
It is so beautiful. It's so breathtaking. So I mean, that's just a part of it. So the end of that little quick story is that here I am with one of the largest groups of students that I had ever taken into this hotel. It's built into the side of the mountain with an earthquake. And we had an earthquake that was too close for my taste, frankly.
That must have been scary.
It was, Chris, it was incredible. I had taken a Valium because I was like, you know, like jet lagged from coming over, and I had to get some sleep.
Yeah.
You know, because here I am, I'm the, you know, and I'm giving a lecture the next day and all of this. And, you know, you don't know a earthquake is coming. And so what I remember is being in this room, and the bed, it was a wooden bed, and the bed starts traveling across the room at the same time that what sounded like a freight train is happening. And then the next thing that happens is the doors. Bam, 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 bam.
Oh, no.
Students crying. And they're like, oh, my God, what's going on? Where's the teacher? Where's the teacher? And so, you know, here I'm gathering them around me, you know, and we're all sort of like hugging each other and going down into the lobby, the main lobby, to find out what exactly happened. Because none of us had ever lived through an earthquake. And this was serious.
Yeah, it was a wow.
And but fortunately, I mean, it was far enough away from us that there was some damage, but no serious damage, like something like a wall falling down or something. And then the students continued to freak out because the bus driver, knowing exactly what he was doing, goes out into the bus and he moves it away from, you know, like buildings or something, you know, so that if something did fall,
yeah,
you know, the bus would be okay. Well, he didn't stop to tell us on the way that he was getting into the bus in order to make the bus safe. A couple of girls start screaming, "He's leaving without us!"
Oh my!
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have, and as I said, I have a story like that for every place that we would go to. If people come out of this going, maybe I should go to Greece, the answer is yes. I always say to people that I think one's education should start there. Yeah. Everything that we care about started there. It's unbelievable.
I agree, because I'm a part of Orlando Stoics. Me and my friend go to a Stoics meeting, so we try to read like Marcus Aurelius and Seneca, stuff like that.
Yeah, we love Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He's one of my favorite Stoics.
You ever read Hadrian?
I want to pick up that book. I haven't yet. I've read Letters to a Stoic and Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. Uh-huh. I think book 2 and 3.
Yeah. Well, that's really wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Of course, you got to read Plato.
I do. I have to get my hands on it.
And then it gets a little more involved with Aristotle.
Yeah.
And did you know that Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander the Great?
No, I did not, actually.
He was literally hired by Alexander's father to be Alexander's tutor.
Wow.
Alexander the Great studied under Aristotle.
I did not know that. That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's like, can you imagine? Oh, yeah, my teacher was Aristotle. Like, him?
Him? Really?
Really?
What? To the great philosopher? Is it true that most of our philosophy came from Greece now?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, in all of its varied forms as well. You come from more or less the Stoic branch.
Yeah.
By the way, that's congratulations, because that's one of the toughest of the groups to try and really fully comprehend. Because, I mean, the word Stoic, of course, comes from Stoicism. And,
yeah.
They were not an easy people to get along with.
No.
Because Stoics would have their own idea of what Stoicism should be. And that was pretty much true of all the philosophers.
Yeah, they did. They had their own.
But the Stoics were worse.
They were. I remember Marcus Aurelius would sometimes, he would make himself poor for a week. Like, he would just sit in the slums, like, you know, as a Stoic practice.
Yep.
Which was interesting enough. And
yeah, well, the emperors, I mean, when you really start getting into the Roman emperors, now that's a whole other kettle of fish.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's the Stoics from ancient Greece, and you have to keep in mind, we're talking about 200 to 300 years later, is Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
I mean, there you are. The entire time, you know, that the United States has been in existence, you know, is the kind of time that we're talking about.
Yeah, the short time.
Which is one of the reasons why I do that with my students, so that they come to grips with the idea of time that we as Americans really can't really get our heads around, because nothing that we know of
has been
lasted
around
that long.
Yeah. Right. We've only been here 241 years or so.
Precisely.
Which is crazy. Now we're going to turn gears on this interview and get a little more personal with you and about your struggles with, would you say it's cancer you've had struggles with over the years?
I'm going into year 15 of my struggle with cancer.
15 years.
In my last meeting with my internist, he looked at me and he said, "You do realize, don't you, that you're a walking miracle?" I almost died a year ago.
Really?
On November 14, I was on the operating table, and they said that they actually thought that they had lost me twice. Now, I only had one outer body experience. But since then, an incredible, I have 12 doctors, Chris.
Wow.
Everybody has done their part in bringing me to the point where today I feel as if I don't have it at all. And a year ago, when it was really bad, the people who understand the thing called the PSA will understand how bad it was when I say that I had come back from Greece, and it was October, and I was feeling really sick, really sick. And my PSA went to 619.
Oh, my.
Now, the highest that your doctor ever wants your PSA to go is 4.
Oh, my gosh.
And so from 619 from last November to this November, doing chemo, and I certainly never thought that I would be an advertisement for chemo, because it is horrible. I mean, apparently it's not nearly as bad as it used to be. But I wouldn't know and wouldn't want to know.
Because, yeah.
Because even what I experience has been pretty rough. But thanks to the doctors and the medicines and these things, my PSA has gone from 619 a year ago to 0.9 today.
Amazing.
where I have the PSA of a teenage boy.
That's amazing. You have some incredible doctors behind this. Wow.
It was so beautiful. I mean, when the doctor got that one, you know, and he looked at me and he said, "Happy birthday. We just added some years to your life." It's really something.
That's incredible.
I am so grateful and so deeply humbled by how I've been taken care of. All of them. Dr. Carlos Acevedo, especially. After my third operation a year ago, I woke up and there, sitting beside my bed, was Dr. Acevedo, who started talking me into the fact that I had to do chemo. And I kept saying over and over again, "Look, if all I have is 2 years, I'd rather live it without the whole chemo thing." And it's really tough. It is tough, Chris. I mean, when I was on the full dose thing, I'm in part two, what they call now, the dosage has been cut in half. But when I was on the full dose thing, it was very hard for me to even make like a dinner date because I could never be 100% sure that I could eat. I mean, it's that simple.
Oh, that sounds awful.
And, but when he told me that my PSA was now 0.9, I thought, wow, it was really worth it. And it was. I mean, as much as I say, going through it is tough. I mean, people who know me know that I now walk with a cane. I have to. Yeah. The cancer has metastasized into the bone of my pelvis, and so that's bad. But the PSA at 0.9 means that they have stopped the growth of the cancer.
Awesome.
And
good.
That's totally amazing.
That is a miracle.
It's, well, like my doctor said, I'm a walking miracle.
Yeah, because 649 to 0.9, that is an incredible leap.
Yeah.
And I can imagine your struggle with chemo was incredibly hard, because I remember my godfather, Tony, who had pancreatic cancer but unfortunately lost, he went through chemo, and this was back 2004. And it was really bad.
That was when it was much harder than apparently what I went through.
He couldn't eat. His belly was bloated and his skin turned yellow.
Yeah, well, God bless him and everybody who went before. And God bless us all who made it. And God bless those of us who didn't.
Exactly.
I just know that right now I have a much better opportunity for living than I did a year ago. It's crazy.
It is. And you don't even look like a man with cancer. You look like a healthy person right now, like a healthy man.
Thank you.
You do.
I love hearing that, of course. and it really feels very different too. I mean, imagine 1 year. I mean, a year ago I was in the hospital.
Now here you are.
And now here I am.
Triumphed over cancer.
Well, I'm never going to do
both
that.
Both knock on wood.
But, you know.
But you're a
thanks
story.
Thanks to, you know, God and prayer circles. And, I mean, if I'm in as many prayer circles as people say I am, I am a testament to the idea of prayer.
Yes, you are. And you are a testament to people fighting out there, too.
Yeah, that's part of it. I mean, because there are people who apparently just crawl into bed and pull up the covers and say, you know, that's it. But that would, of course, never be me.
And I see that.
Because you know, I'm like, hey, I got to see the Nutcracker.
I got to go get up and do
right,
my thing.
Right.
You know?
I got to go see A Christmas Carol. Of which, by the way, I'm going to see four this season.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, it's I I love that part of my life because I have a weekly column that I write as well, where I tell people about the different things that are happening.
Josh Garrick recommends.
Yeah, Josh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fun of that is you know, getting to go and see, you know, all these different things. So,
and it makes your life that much more full.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And with that, we've reached the top of the hour of the experience with Chris Fio. And I want to say, Josh, thank you for just considering coming on here and talking with me about your life and your struggles and your triumphs.
Well, it's my pleasure. And you're a good interviewer.
Well, thank you. I was hoping I did good for this one.
Oh, you know, well, I think people will see that we had fun.
They did.
I think that's going to come through.
I think they will.
So, thank you, Chris.
Go, but right now I know there's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. Just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. Just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me.
The Experience with Chris Fio is produced by Boris Douglas Garbe and Kai Legal. It is a joint production of Borma, Vonti, and PFT Media. The theme song is You and Me by NWAR Superstar.
A PFT Media production.